what sort of gold chat have you got sorted then?
None.
The CMU podcast in association with 7 Digital.
This week, YouTube, Avenged Sevenfold and the Smiths. It's the CMU podcast, looking back at the last week in the music business. I'm Andy Malt. I have with me Chris Cook. Hello, Chris Cook.
Hello, Andy Malt.
Hi, Chris Cook.
How are you?
I'm good. It says next in the notes that we should have some solid gold chat.
And I
haven't thought of anything.
Given you wrote the notes, I'm sure you've come prepared with some solid gold chat with which to entertain the CMU podcast listener.
I was hoping that something would have happened to you.
I'm going to Manchester tomorrow. Well,
not
tonight.
Good enough.
Tonight, actually.
Not good enough.
By the time the podcast goes out, I will be in Manchester.
Not good enough.
At the Off the Record event, which is a new event happening in Manchester, a daytime stuff, talks, panels, that kind of thing. I'm doing the CMU DIY Beginner's Guide to the Music Industry in 45 minutes at 10 a.m. Do you think the people of Manchester get up at 10 a.m.? Or do you think I might be talking to myself?
I think you'll be talking to yourself.
So I would plug it, but there's no point because by the time this podcast goes out, I will already have delivered the talk. So there is no benefit to plugging it. So I'm going to be in Manchester. Then there's gigs in the evening. This is the festival that they've only just announced the lineup. So although tickets have been on sale for months, they only announced the lineup today ahead of tomorrow. And then they had all of these people.
Had they forgotten to book anyone?
No. They had all of these people who were picking bands. It's a new band thing happening in the Northern Quarter. Is that what they call it? That bit of Manchester?
The Northern Quarter, you
mean? Where the cool little venues are. And they got all these people to recommend bands. And so they've announced the lineup. And then alongside each band, it tells you who recommended it. So if you go and you hate what you see, I assume that there's then a procedure that you can go and there'll be an app that will tell you where the person who recommended the band is, because they'll be in one of the venues and you can go and shout in their face. So it's a great concept.
Sounds like a good
idea. I'm looking forward to downloading the app, which I'm assuming I'm going to get. And then after Off the Record Manchester, I'm going to go south a little to home of Harry Styles. But not only home of Harry Styles, Holmes Chapel, also now home of the award-winning Blue Dot Festival, Holmes Chapel.
So is that in Holmes Chapel?
I mean, the people of Goostrey would probably say it's more Goostrey. The
is
people of
like
Chelford might say it's almost Chelford. But I would say that the Jodrell Bank Telescope belongs to Holmes Chapel. When I did my project on the history of Holmes Chapel, aged whenever I was, 9. I definitely did the history of Jodrell Bank under the header, the history of Holmes Chapel. So we claim Jodrell Bank and therefore we claim the award-winning, as of this week, Blue Dot Festival.
Well, I asked you for solid gold chat and you failed. Let's just get on with it.
It was definitely chat.
You made some noise.
You did.
Let's get going.
This will be another week where someone tweets our podcast and tells people what time they have to go to skip the intro chat, as someone did a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
There'll be another tweet
rightly
going
so.
Out. If you want insightful conversation about the YouTube gamer deal, go to, and then however many minutes we are currently in.
Well, coming up this week in the CMU podcast, we'll be talking about Avenged Sevenfold and how they've shot themselves in the foot by releasing a new album.
Or not.
Who knows? We'll be talking about how Brexit is stopping the Smiths from reforming. But first, let's talk about how the unthinkable has happened and now music videos haven't been made legal in Germany. Which is a slight misrepresentation of our first story.
That is a slight misrepresentation of our
very,
first
very
story.
Very, very slight.
But yeah, so Gamer.
Yep.
They being the German PRS. We talked about PRS last
Maybe
week.
Maybe PRS is the English gamer, British gamer.
Oh, that's a good question, that, because most of the big European collecting societies who represent song rights are of a similar age. PRS celebrated its 100th birthday, didn't they, a couple of years ago?
Yes.
So they're just over 100 years old.
Yes, with their 100 years of music slogan with no context.
Well,
like, is it 100 years since music has been invented?
Well, before PRS, there was no music.
Okay, so
we all know that.
Well, therefore, it must be that Gamer is the German PRS. They established it.
Well, exactly, yes, because there would have been no music for Gamer to represent.
There was no music before PRS.
Well, except that perhaps Gamer existed, but with nothing to represent. Perhaps it was the 20 years of Gamer.
That would explain a lot about how Gamer works.
Yeah, it wasn't designed to license things. It was just licensed to be a building. Anyway, Gamer.
Well, yeah, and not licensing is what Gamer has been doing for 7 years.
So Gamer It's the German PRS. They represent the song copyright in various scenarios within Germany. Actually, they're more powerful than PRS for various reasons. One reason being, here in the UK, there are different elements to the copyright, which we've talked about endlessly on the podcast. So you can talk about the performing rights of the song and the mechanical rights of the song. And in the UK, those are split, and PRS actually only directly controls the performing rights in songs. Publishers control the mechanical rights in songs, and they sometimes use MCPS, the separate collecting society, to do the licensing, which confusingly then outsources that to PRS, so that sort of messes things up slightly. But sometimes the publishers can license the mechanical rights directly. Whereas in Germany, GEMA represents the performing rights and the mechanical rights and some other rights too. So GEMA is a very powerful organisation in Germany, licensing many elements of the song copyrights for the German song catalogue. And of all the collecting societies in the world, more or less, GEMA is known for being the hardest work when it comes to getting your license.
Yes.
Particularly in digital. So if you're launching a new digital service, it has generally been accepted, as all the different sort of digital services have come to market, that you do your label deals first, usually. Then you go and do your deals with the big five publishers. We'll give you Anglo-American repertoire from the big five. And then you go and do your collecting society deals. And you go around country to country and you do your deals with each of the collecting societies around the world. And GEMA is probably the one who are going to drive the hardest bargain. Do you remember we were at Reeperbahn a few years ago?
Yes.
And that was the early days of Spotify. So yeah. Spotify was still relatively new at that point.
So it must have been, what was that, 2008, 2009?
I would say it was later than that. Is it really that long since I last went to Reeperbahn? Because that's the last time I went to Reeperbahn.
Yeah.
Anyway, they were having a conversation about Spotify, which was still relatively new at the time, and crucially had not launched in Germany at that point. And there was someone from GEMA on the panel who was certainly good value for a panel, because he was basically saying, we're never licensing Spotify unless they fundamentally change their way of doing business. Nope, no Spotify in Germany. Although they did subsequently license Spotify.
Not that long later.
I don't know whether Spotify did fundamentally change its pitch. Who knows? But certainly GEMA do generally drive a harder bargain when it comes to licensing digital services. But their dispute with YouTube is probably the highest profile of GEMA's standoff with a big digital service. So this began in 2009. So in the very early days of there being music on YouTube, there were some deals being done between GEMA and YouTube. But then in 2009, they basically reached a point where they couldn't agree ultimately on rates. And so GEMA said, right, that's it. We're not licensing you, YouTube. We don't care if that means no music on YouTube. Who cares? Who cares if there's no music on YouTube?
There's loads of music everywhere else.
There's music everywhere else. So that's it. Unless you will move on royalties, we're not licensing you. So since 2009, YouTube has not had a GEMA license in Germany, which means that music videos within Germany, which are of songs which are in turn represented by GEMA, in theory can't be legitimately on YouTube. So that means two things. First of all, when it comes to official channels by labels, well, they need to play ball. They can't be seen to be breaking GEMA's rules. So it means there can't be official channels. So, for example, there can't be Vivo channels in Germany that have videos which contain GEMA-represented songs. And when it comes to user-generated content, well, in theory, that can't contain GEMA repertoire either, although there has then been a 7-year side squabble, which actually has not been resolved, over whose responsibility it is to ensure that no GEMA repertoire appears in user-generated content on YouTube, which brings us back to your favourite topic.
The safe harbours.
Good old safe harbours. And whether or not the responsibility to keep GEMA repertoire off YouTube in user-generated content is YouTube's problem or GEMA's problem. And that has been to court, and actually in that dispute, we've had some of the sort of test rulings on quite how safe harbours work or don't work from a music industry's perspective in Europe. And actually YouTube has enjoyed some success in that ongoing squabble. But meanwhile, over here, away from the safe harbours debate, it was ultimately about royalties. And certainly when other people in the music industry have been driving or trying to drive a harder bargain with YouTube, it's not only about royalties. Because, well, there's two elements to royalties in streaming. There's revenue share, and then there's a sort of minimum fee, a minimum guarantee. And generally speaking, on rev share, YouTube is offering a pretty similar deal to everybody else. So Gamer would probably be looking for somewhere around about 12% of any ad revenue that is locked to a Gamer work. Don't know that for certain, don't know the specifics of this deal, but that's probably what they're pushing for. Maybe up as high as 15%, but probably more around about 12%. And it seems likely that YouTube would offer that rev share. YouTube are fine on rev share. What they're not so keen on is minimum guarantees. Yeah. What if there is no advertising? And that is normally where there is a sticking point. And whereas the other collecting societies and record companies have become increasingly annoyed about that sticking point, but have continued to do business with YouTube throughout, actually PRS had its own squabble with YouTube around about the same time as the Gamer fallout. So I think actually even before that, 2008, 2009. But that only lasted a few months and then PRS did their deal and everything's been rolling on ever since. Whereas Gamer were very much, nope, we're just not doing the deal. Don't care if that means no music videos on YouTube in Germany. And that's been that way for 7 years now, until this week.
Yeah, when they suddenly did a deal.
A deal has been done. So Gamer is now licensing YouTube in Germany, which means A, user-generated content can start to have Gamer-represented songs in it again. And perhaps more importantly, it means that record company-controlled YouTube channels, presumably Vivo-controlled YouTube channels, although actually, beyond YouTube, Vivo did do a deal with Gamer. So if you went to Vivo.com, which most people don't really even know exists, but presumably some Germans do, because Vivo on its own platform has had a Gamer license for a while now. But I'm assuming this means that Vivo channels on YouTube will also now be able to pop up in Germany again.
Yeah, which is quite a dramatic shift, because it has meant, you know, for 7 years, if you've gone to watch a music video on YouTube in Germany, the high probability is that you're just going to be met with a screen that says, sorry, this video isn't licensed in your country, you can't watch it.
The little red box, isn't it, yeah, that you get, that they were saying, no more red boxes.
Which, you know, I mean, apparently some people have been very supportive of this and kind of seen Gamer as the real defenders of songwriter rights in the world. Although most of the people I've ever spoken to about it who live in Germany just hate Gamer. I'm like, why won't you let music videos be on YouTube? It would be really helpful.
By which you mean consumers or people within the industry?
Both.
Both.
I mean, generally, if we've published stories about Gamer in the past, any comments we would get would generally be from people saying, I hate Gamer, they're rubbish.
But it is interesting that 7 years ago, when Gamer first fell out with YouTube, and I say PRS had a albeit quite short-lived falling out with YouTube around about the same time, but in the main, around about then, 2009, 2010, the music industry was sort of falling in love with YouTube. And while they were dissing Google for things like search and the fact that Google search was linking off to all of these piracy sites, YouTube was the bit of Google that we liked, because it was starting to get phenomenal traffic. We were putting videos up. YouTube were putting advertising around those videos. We were starting to see income coming in. It was pretty much the only ad-funded streaming service that was actually gaining any traction. And most certainly on the record industry side, the record companies sort of like, oh, we like YouTube, we'll embrace it. It's a great marketing channel. We get the ad share. That's all fab. And in most other countries, the collecting societies, perhaps not quite so in love with YouTube, but recognised that it was income, that, well, it would be mad to turn that income away. Yet Gamer sort of stood its ground. And yet here we are 7 years later, and now sort of everyone else is of the same opinion of Gamer. I mean, not that they've gone as far as blocking YouTube, but a lot more people in the music rights industry, certainly at record companies and music publishers and other collecting societies, are much more critical of YouTube now in the way Gamer always has been, although they continue to work with it. So it's sort of, I think I said in my article on this in the CMU Daily, it's sort of, it's typical of contrary Gamer, yeah. That they wait until everyone else agrees with them and then they say, right, now we're going to, now's the time to license YouTube.
And YouTube made a big deal of this. They called it a landmark agreement. And, well, it is quite a big deal, I guess, you know, after 7 years of trying to get music videos on YouTube in Germany.
And of course, you know, Germany is, I mean, sometimes third, sometimes I think currently fourth biggest recorded music market in the world, alongside UK, US and Japan. So, you know, from a record industry point of view, it's a very big, important market that has been deprived YouTube as a sort of a hub of music up until now. And I mean, you were sort of referencing that certainly fans never liked this, but there were plenty of people in the music industry who didn't like this. And I think even now, although the official line now in the music rights industry is YouTube is evil, would you talk to the managers or even some of the labels working with younger artists for whom YouTube is still this phenomenal marketing platform? And while nobody might be happy with the fact that YouTube's user figures continue to go up, but the ad income is pretty much static, so the money the music industry is receiving is sort of the same as it was a year ago, yet there are many more people streaming music on YouTube, and lots of people might not like that, but lots of managers and labels working with new young artists still say, but we still got to work with YouTube because it's such a good marketing channel. And that is something that managers and labels working with young artists, not to mention young artists who are gamer members, have not had in Germany for 7 years. They've been missing this sort of marketing channel. Unless, of course, they had a sort of fan base who know what a VPN is, in which case it's possibly not been so big a problem. But it is quite a landmark move. We don't know the exact specifics of the deal, although we have been led to believe that there is some back pay going on here. So where gamer repertoire has been on YouTube, presumably when it slipped through, even though it shouldn't have been on there, that there will be some back pay on that, although we're not quite sure what that means. And of course, there still remains the Safe Harbors squabble that everybody is having, which is, well, what about content where a song or recording streams, but there is no advertising, so therefore the rev share is zero. But generally, even more so on the publishing side than the label side, the position is it doesn't matter whether or not there's any ad income, you are still obliged to pay us a minimum rate, which they may or may not be doing. I suspect they probably are paying some minimum rate, but who knows? So Gamer, actually, to be fair, of the collecting societies out there, tend to be more transparent with their members on how these deals work, whereas lots of other collecting societies, like the record companies and the music publishers, tend to keep lots of secrets about the way these deals work. Yeah. So it may well be that enough members of Gamer learn about the specifics of this deal that ultimately that will become public knowledge. We'll see, I guess.
That could be interesting in the ongoing wider Safe Harbors debate with YouTube.
Indeed. The last thing to say about this is that within Europe in the last few years, another development we've seen in terms of the collecting societies on the publishing side, the songwriting side, is certain societies forming alliances and then these things that they're calling hubs. And ICE is one of those hubs. And ICE is PRS, Stim and Gamer have come together. They've launched this separate organisation that is both licensing all three societies' repertoires on a pan-European basis and then doing all the processing of all the data and the money. And that's interesting. It's, I think, a sensible thing to happen. And then the Southern European societies have their own sort of competing hub. But it has been interesting that since PRS, Stim and Gamer started working together, one of the questions I said to PRS as soon as they announced that Gamer were now part of this joint venture and that they were going to be doing joint licensing for the three societies on a pan-European basis, well, what about YouTube? I surely won't be able to do a YouTube license because Gamer is famously a holdout. And it was sort of like, well, yes, it might be that ICE doesn't license YouTube, or if it does, Gamer would have to be able to sit out of that license. But now Gamer is working with YouTube. It could be that ICE ultimately does take over the YouTube relationship. And if it does, perhaps a result of that is, if Gamer have got better rates out of YouTube as a result of Gamer playing hardball for 7 years, perhaps that could filter out across the ICE joint venture and therefore would ultimately apply to PRS and Stim as well. Yes. But now I'm wildly speculating.
Yes. Well, the other thing that ICE has done this week is a new deal with SoundCloud.
It has indeed. And I suppose that is, I assume, because PRS famously did a deal with SoundCloud, having threatened to take them to court. So PRS did do a deal with SoundCloud around their new ad platform and the subscription SoundCloud Go service that, I don't know, I'm assuming at least 14 people have now signed up to.
You think it's that many?
Well, surely some people who work there, they probably get free accounts, don't they? So that wouldn't apply. But PRS did sign up to SoundCloud Go quite early on. So yes, and now ICE have, and that may well be that the template deal that PRS did has now extended out so that the other ICE partners will benefit from that.
Yes, so lots of licensing fun to be had. And hey, Germans, if you're listening, enjoy those music videos. Okay, still to come. We'll talk through a few more of this week's music business stories in brief and discover how narrowly we avoided a Smiths reunion. But first, let's talk about Avenged Sevenfold, who are back with a new album. In fact, you might remember last week on the podcast, while we were discussing virtual reality, we were talking about how, at the time we were recording, Avenged Sevenfold were about to live stream a gig in VR.
Did you VR it?
No, because I was here.
Oh, could you not do it afterwards? Did you have to watch it live? Was it not online for like another 48 hours or something?
Well, that was on Facebook. I'm not sure if that... I think the Facebook stream was just in crappy old 2D.
So you think to actually get the VR experience, you had to be online at
also,
the
I have
moment.
No means by which to look at VR stuff. So no, I didn't do that. But the other thing that happened while they were doing their show is that they surprise released their new album, The Stage, which is notable for a number of reasons. One, it's their first album for Universal's Capitol label. Two, it's a new album, that's fun.
It's a surprise release.
It's a surprise release.
I mean, it's got to the point now where surprise releases are generally not that surprising. But I suppose what was surprising for a surprise release...
Well, I suppose what they were doing, they'd spun this VR gig as it being the launch show for Universal's new VR platform. And actually, it was a thing to promote their new record.
So you were surprised.
There was a bit of a, like, whoa, bait and switch. Ah.
And I suppose often when there are surprise releases, they're digital only. But actually, there was CDs for this. The physical release did follow the next day, New Music Friday, and all of that. So it was a full-on proper album release that hadn't been pre-announced. So yeah, that was the other thing. What else was notable?
Well, as I said, it's their first album for Universal. It's notably not an album that they've released through Warner. Warner would say that they're still owed another album.
Yes, this shouldn't be the first album for Universal. It should be the last album for the Warner Brothers label, who, until earlier this year, were under the impression that they were still Avenged Sevenfold's label.
Yes, because Avenged Sevenfold suddenly announced that they were no longer signed to Warner Brothers because they were using the seven-year rule under Californian employment law for personal services contracts, which many an artist has used successfully and unsuccessfully to get out of their deals. Well, I think we've talked about it before on the podcast, but it's a rule that says you can't be contracted to provide a personal service for more than 7 years. And obviously record contracts are generally done on number of albums rather than length of time. So, as I said, Avenged Sevenfold have released 4 albums through Warner and they were due to release a 5th, but they decided, no, I don't want to do that, and just walked off and signed to Capitol.
And we knew all of this before the Capitol deal was announced because Warner sued them.
Yes.
So earlier this year, before any of the new album was on the radar, Warner went to court over this. So yes, this 7-year rule. So first of all, they're a California band, which is how they can benefit from this bit of Californian employment law. And this 7-year rule has cropped up various times before in the entertainment industry. And actually, I mean, it wasn't specifically written for the entertainment industry, although actually I think most of the big cases where the 7-year rule is employed are entertainment industry cases. And in the music industry, sometimes when you've got an artist who is contracted to a company or a manager or an agent and then bails on that deal citing the 7-year rule, so the deal is now 7 years old, so I can walk away from it, whatever the contract says. And then sometimes you end up in debates of, well, is it a personal services contract or is it not a personal services contract? Does this rule apply? So usually there's lots of sort of legal wrangling and complexities and complications when this rule is instigated. And when Warner sued earlier this year, there were various arguments that they were putting forward. It wasn't entirely clear what their interpretation of the law was, but what they seemed to be saying was that their contract with Avenged Sevenfold was a lot older than 7 years. Okay, so I think it was like 2004, I think, 2005, yes, that they did the original deal. So 7 years had long since passed. And what they were saying was that once album number 4 was out of the way and had been promoted, they very much gave the label the impression, this is what Warner was saying, that they were going to work together on album 5.
Yes.
Warner said that they'd started to spend quite a bit of money organising that. Don't quite know what that money had been spent on.
They'd spent money on recordings.
So they'd sent them into the studio, they'd done a bit of budgeting and all of that. And therefore, even though the contract may well be well over 7 years old, all of that implied that they were going to work together on this 5th album. And they were sort of trying to use that as an argument in that litigation earlier this year to say that these were all reasons why, at this point in the process, the band shouldn't be allowed to declare, that's it, contract over, 7 years has expired, long expired, and therefore we're going to walk away, we're free agents, and we can go and do a deal with another record company.
Yeah, the band's lawyer, Howard King, his counter-arguments were that, like, it's not our fault if you put money into something that was ultimately going to come to nothing for you. Bad luck you. Also used the old, lots of key people who used to work with the band at the label have now moved on and no longer work there, and so it's all people that the band don't know so well.
And that was their justification for why they wanted to leave.
Yes.
And also, I mean, he denied that the label had ever been misled. Yeah. And so All of that kicked off earlier this year. It's still going through the motions. But what came to light once this new album came out, this being, as you say, album number one for Capitol, could have been album number five for Warner. We hear on the grapevine that Warner are now planning on releasing a best of next month.
Without the involvement of the band, the classic move.
The best kind of best of. So basically taking tracks from the four albums that they released and just releasing that. And I guess in one way that would be album number five. It's actually quite common when you do a record deal and you're committed to deliver a certain number of albums. It's very common that the last of those albums is a greatest hits, which is a way of bringing a record contract to completion quicker than otherwise would be if you were doing a brand new album.
It's a bit of a diss, isn't it, to go like, here's the greatest hits album, best of record. It's got none of the tracks from the album they released a month ago.
Yeah, because these are the greatest, the best records. So Warner are apparently bringing out this best of next month without the band's involvement. This is according to the aforementioned Howard King. Apparently the label, I think this was rumour rather than a statement. The rumour was that the label was saying, but this was already on the agenda before we parted company, so it's not something that we've just thrown in at the last minute. But as the dispute over the seven-year rule works its way through the system, apparently, and I didn't actually realise this when the litigation was filed earlier this year, apparently, even if Warner was to accept that Avenged Sevenfold were allowed to walk away from this deal, despite any conversations that may have taken place previously, because the seven-year rule should apply to their agreement with Warner Brothers, even if Warner either voluntarily or were forced to accept that, there is an extra little proviso on the seven-year rule that was put in there some time ago, not when this rule was originally done, which is a long time ago, but some time ago. And apparently the Wall Street Journal said this was an extra bit of law that was added as a result of lobbying by the record industry, which basically says that if an artist employs the seven-year rule, and that means that a label misses out on an album or a couple of albums that they would have otherwise had under contract, the label can sue for damages for the missing albums. And as I say, this was an extra little proviso that was put into the law around the seven-year rule, because labels were saying the seven-year rule might be fine for movie studios, but record industry works differently. And record companies put a lot of investment up front in the first couple of albums, a lot of marketing around those first couple of albums to build the artist brand up, based on the idea that if that works, that they then get the kickback of the next two or three albums that come under that record contract.
So, yeah, you make a loss initially you gradually claw it back.
Correct. So the record industry lobbied the Californian lawmakers and said, we're not quite like the movie studios or the TV companies where perhaps the seven-year rule makes sense. So we're not saying that there shouldn't be a seven-year rule, but there should be this sort of a bit of compensation for the record companies. So this was added some time ago, although I've not delved into this myself, and I'm not an expert on Californian employment law, or labor law, as they would call it in the US. But the Wall Street Journal was seemingly suggesting that although this was added some time ago, it's never really been tested.
Right.
We've not really had any particularly big landmark cases on this. So the perception is that this is actually what Warner will fight Avenged Sevenfold on when it gets to court next year, which is saying, OK, if you're going to walk away from us, we need compensation because we've lost this last album that we were expecting to get. The question is, well, how do you work out what that compensation should be? Is it how much the label had already paid and that they want to get that money back, Warner having said that they've already spent money? Or is it more what the label might have made had a fifth album come out?
Yes. And if the band hadn't released an album, then that's sort of guesswork.
Well, exactly. If you are going with the idea, well, Warner should be able to sue for what they've missed out on because there wasn't a fifth album, how the hell do you work out what a fifth album would have sold? Well, now we'll have a fifth album that we can look at.
You can look at the sales figures
and see exactly how much money it generated.
And presumably, they're signed to Universal, the biggest major label, they're being launched as a new Universal act with this big virtual reality live streamed gig on the internet, that would suggest that Universal is banking on this being quite successful and therefore could mean quite a payday for Warner if this case goes in Warner's favour.
The aforementioned Howard King has already thought about this.
Yes.
And in his response, he was basically saying, no, you can't do that. You can't say, well, whatever Universal made is what Warner would have made, and therefore that's what the band owes their former label. Because who knows, if Warner had put this record out, they would have done it in a different way.
Well, his exact words
well, it was
were,
a great, good
they would
quote.
Have screwed it up. He said, we don't know what Warner could have done with an Avenged album other than screw it up.
Which is like, he's always good for a quote, this lawyer. And then he went on to say, you know, obviously Universal had put this band as part of this big, really hyped VR thing, and that has got them into the news, which will hopefully sell more records. And therefore, you can't just say whatever money Universal make is what Warner would have made, because Warner probably wouldn't have done any of that.
Well, they don't have their own VR platform.
They don't have their own. I don't know, do they? They certainly have not been talking about it in the way Universal have. So you can't just apply that. But as I say, when this case gets to court, it will be interesting to see how things are fought on the day. It may well be that the band say, well, you've had your greatest hits. That's album number 5. So go away, stop moaning. But it may well be that they subpoena off Universal all of the finances on this new album and then try and make a claim based on that.
But that's all to look forward to.
It is.
And I guess something we'll come back to later.
Who knows,
if perhaps, when it happens.
If this actually gets to court and the band are there, perhaps this could be the first virtual reality court case. Perhaps Universal could put their kit into the courtroom and it would be like you were there.
That would be fun.
It would be. That's something that perhaps
I might buy a headset for that.
If that was what you were going to get. Hey, if the Blurred Lines appeal actually goes to court, I think you could make good money doing a VR coverage of that.
Yeah, you probably could. Like when, you know, in the last one when Robin Thicke had a little tinkle on the piano.
Got his piano out.
That would be quite good in VR, wouldn't it? It wouldn't.
It would be like,
you know, come on, we're just brainstorming ideas here. How are we going to get this VR court case going?
We'll gatecrash Universal's offices this week. We'll see what technology they've got, and then we'll tell them how to employ it. It's all going to work. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, good. Well, we'll revisit that later then. Hey, how about we look through a few other music business stories from the last week, just in brief. There's no need to chat through them in detail. Let's just knock through them.
Okay.
The government is something we've talked about before, I think. The government has pledged a meeting to discuss tackling ticket tout bots, which means Nigel Adams MP has withdrawn his proposal for an amendment to the Digital Economy Bill.
Yes, Nigel Adams was proposing to add a line to this miscellaneous Digital Economy Bill that would have outlawed the use of bot software that ticket touts use to hoover up loads of tickets when they go on sale on the primary sites. However, what the government have said is, if you read the Waterson Review of Secondary Ticketing, which was that report that came out earlier this year, he reckons that that might already be illegal under the Computer Electronics Something Act that you've not put in the notes.
The Computer Misuse Act.
It may be that commuters are already breaking the law on this.
Please don't misuse any commuters on your way home.
So basically, it might already be illegal, so we ought to check whether or not that is the case, and if it is the case, we ought to start enforcing that before we put in a bit of new law. But hey, Nige, fan of Green Day, you may recall us, I think we talked about that,
yes,
on the podcast.
He's heard of them.
Hey, Nige, don't worry, we're going to have a meeting this side of Christmas, and we're going to come together, and we're going to see if we can get something moving on all of this without having to put something in the Digital Economy Bill. So leave it with us. Don't amend the act.
No one wants more laws.
Meanwhile, Matt Hancock, the digital and culture minister who is instigating this meeting, would just like everyone to know that he's heard of Paul Simon.
Yes.
So that was the other important outcome of the meeting that happened in Parliament this week on that point.
Another story we actually discussed last week, I think in brief as well, was the problem of counterfeit CDs on Amazon. And now the RIAA has done some research and discovered that basically a quarter of CDs on Amazon are fake.
So last time it was the A2IM. I wish the Americans trade bodies would get easier names to say.
The American Association of Independent Music.
So the indie labels trade body in America had put out this memo to their members saying, we reckon quite a lot of CDs being sold on Amazon by third parties who are using the Amazon platform and possibly Amazon fulfillment are actually bootlegs, probably coming out of China. And then this week, yes, we heard from the Recording Industry Association of America, which represents the majors, that when they got, it was 194 CDs they ordered.
Yes.
And I don't quite know how they selected them, but when they arrived, 44 of the 194 were bootlegs.
Yes.
They were counterfeit CDs. And so they are saying to Amazon, you really ought to sort this out. Stop all these counterfeit CDs. Because if it is, I mean, whether or not you can take that, it's a relatively small bit of research. But if it really was something like a quarter of all the CDs are being sold on Amazon,
yeah,
bearing in mind how important Amazon now is as a CD seller,
yeah,
that means all of our stats about the physical market are being all screwed up. Because,
yeah, maybe CDs are a lot more popular than we think.
A lot more CDs are being sold.
Well, that's the thing, actually. I mean, I noticed that someone on Twitter, this story got a reply on Twitter from someone saying, come on, guys, it's 2016, CDs really. But CDs are selling very well and are possibly selling 25% better than we thought.
And I mean, these are US stats, and CDs are a smaller part of the American record industry. They're bigger here in the UK, so if it applies here in the UK as well. I thought the other interesting thing that the RIAA submission was saying, actually, I think this was possibly part of that anti-piracy thing that they submitted recently. Anyway, I don't know, but it was an interesting observation that they were making, which is, if you're going to buy counterfeit CDs, get them from China, not Russia. Because the Chinese ones, you can hardly tell the difference. Whereas they were saying the Russian ones, the outside of the packaging looks like the real thing. But when you get inside, they've basically made no effort whatsoever. And half the liner notes are in Russian and stuff like that. So if you're going to buy counterfeit CDs, China's the place to go for the real product.
I accidentally bought some counterfeit CDs off eBay
once. I like the accidentally there.
It was accidental. I was expecting the genuine article when this was like 10 years ago or something. And when they arrived, it was so obviously fake. It was,
it was laughable.
I was embarrassed for the counterfeiters.
Well, you should have gone to China for your quality
CDs. Well, it was on the outside. It wasn't even like they'd made no effort at any stage of the process.
Did it just say CD in white on black?
It was very badly. I think they'd just done it on a printer in an office, like a crappy old printer.
Well,
it was just like, it was so, yeah.
Anyway. Amazon are going to sort that out, hopefully.
Brexit. There's been some Brexit stuff this week related to the music industry. There's been a Guardian article and an interview with Rob Hallett, industry veteran, on Billboard, in which, the Guardian article was about the effect of the UK leaving the European Union on the live industry. And obviously, Rob Hallett is a live industry veteran, as I just said, and so that's what he was talking about.
I've not actually read Eamon Ford, isn't it, article
yes.
in The Guardian. You've read it? I've
yes.
not read it yet. It's on my little pocket app to read at the weekend. Was it talking about now, as in, because obviously one of the things that Rob Hallett was talking about was the impact of currency fluctuations on the live market, or was it looking ahead at the potential of new bureaucracy and administration?
It was more looking ahead. And talking about this, there's this thing called the Carnet, which
yes.
is it's your paperwork for getting your equipment round Europe, which used to be the system before we joined the European Union. And that would probably cost about £2,000 a year, which doesn't seem like a lot of money. But if you're a little band trying to, I mean, one person in the article made a point that, like, you know, you'd have to get that even if you were just playing one-off show in France in a year.
I know.
And then, like, that automatically means you have to be of a certain level of income as an artist in order to pay that money up front.
I know I chaired a panel on this issue as part of the BPI's AGM. They have some panels for their members before the formal proceedings, and I chaired that. And one of those was on Brexit, talking about various issues around the potential impact of Brexit. It's all potential. I mean, the main conclusion of the panel was, we just don't know.
Yeah.
But one thing that they were saying is, when it comes to touring, is yes, I suppose at the grassroots level, it might have an impact on the artists themselves. At a higher level, it probably won't have a huge impact on the artist. However, it might on crew, because it might be, if there's a whole load of paperwork
yeah.
to take your lighting guy and your sound guy and all of that with you, well, you'll just hire French people or German people where you don't need to sort out the paperwork. So the artists, or you'll just tolerate the paperwork and whatever. But it might not have so big an impact on the actual act, but on the UK people who tour of those acts around Europe, actually, it could put them out of work, was the conclusion
yes.
there.
Now, Rob Hallett, in his Billboard interview, was more talking about the here and now. I mean, we haven't left the European Union yet, and as we know, the pound has tanked. And he was saying, as a result, it's now 20% more expensive to bring over a US act. And if you're paying a fee of like $50,000 to them, that's a significant extra amount of money. He was saying, in theory...
Yeah, the flip side of that should be, it's more expensive to import US artists, but it should be cheaper to export UK artists. So the flip side of that is that there should be good news for UK artists there, but he had a bit of pessimism about that as well.
Yeah, if they're paying for things like hotel rooms and stuff in advance of leaving, where they have to pay in sterling, that basically offsets any higher income they might make by bringing euros back to the UK. And so... it's of no benefit at all, and it's all rubbish. And then he was also saying, like, and the big problem is, we just don't know what's going to happen, and this could all be a terrible disaster.
Given what happened earlier today, before we did the podcast, which is obviously the court ruling that I'm quite reassured by the court ruling that's happened, which is basically saying that the government can't just begin the exit process on their own. They have to get parliamentary approval, because that does mean that I did understand every bit of constitutional law that I read during my law degree. Yeah. This whole thing was like, did I completely misread all of those textbooks on constitutional law? But seemingly the judges agree with my interpretation of constitutional law, for what it's worth.
Which you weren't asked to present.
I did pretty well in that module on my law degree. But although on one level, I think it's good that we've had that ruling today, which means that there'll have to be parliamentary involvement in the exit process. Although the flip side of that is the one thing that will almost certainly mean is the whole process will be even slower. And I suppose on one level, I think there are some people who voted Remain who sort of hope that we'll just procrastinate, and actually it will never happen. But then there is a flip side of that is if it is going to happen, it might as well happen sooner rather than later, so that we don't have long drawn out, you know, should I be investing here? Should I be, you know, if I'm doing a European touring festival, what will the implications be down the line? If I'm hiring European people into my London office because I quite like a French speaker to be able to speak to my French clients, is that something I should be doing? And really, on one level, it would be good if we could just draw a line and say, this is what's happening in the future. But anyway, yeah, lots of Brexit talk this week in the music business news, and more to come once we get to the final story.
Yeah.
But you have two more quick one-liners you'd like to mention.
Yep. Woman of the Year 2016 is Bono.
Obviously. This is a US magazine, isn't
yes.
it? And he's one of a number of Women of the Year.
Yeah, so every year, Glamour magazine in the US, they pick 8 Women of the Year. This year they couldn't think of 8, so they gave one to Bono.
Except there were the 3 founders of the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah, so they got,
were they counted as one?
They just get one.
Right, so they'd already got more than 8.
Yeah.
So actually they didn't even need Bono to reach their 8. So yeah, Bono is Woman of the Year. The rationale being that he's a big champion for sort of gender rights and female rights. Is he any more than any other sort of left-leaning liberal celebrity?
I don't think it's something he's particularly known for. I mean,
I suppose it is true that these
days, the only thing I remember about Bono now is him talking about airdropping comedians to fight ISIS.
It is true. We've sort of reached a point in human history where whenever Bono speaks, I probably stop listening. So perhaps he has been talking about this a lot this last 18 months. I've just been tuning out the minute he opens his mouth.
I still think they probably could have found a woman to take the prize. I just think, yeah, probably, and it does mean that all the coverage of this is about a man
rather than the other 7, actually 10 women who have been given
yeah.
the honour.
So, of course, that worked out really well.
This is an American magazine, and within a week of this podcast going out, I don't want to, you know, sort of what's the word?
You don't want to jinx it.
Jinx it. That's the word. But in a week's time, it may well be that they have their first ever American president, who one would therefore think probably, before she becomes president and possibly screws everything up, probably deserves to be Woman of the Year in America 2016. Actually, just with all the stick she's taken on the bloody campaign trail, I think she probably deserves the honour. But perhaps they thought that would be too political at this moment, so they give it to Bono instead.
Talking of prizes.
Yeah.
Bob Dylan, turns out he did want his Nobel Prize. He hadn't got round to saying so.
This is something we waffled about on last week's podcast. Actually, by the time the podcast went out, I think he'd already made the phone call and told the award givers of the Nobel Prize for Literature that he was very privileged to get the prize. And of course he'll show up to collect it if it fits with his schedule. There did seem to be a footnote on the, I'll show up to collect it. And was it 900 grand that he was going to get for showing up?
$900,000, yes.
So, well done, Bob.
Obviously, it seems like a weird number. Obviously, that's a conversion from Swedish krona.
Is it?
But I can't remember what the figure is in Swedish krona.
But not so grumpy after all, it turns out.
No, he's a very affable chap. He just takes a little. He doesn't immediately reply to everything. Everyone wants everything now, don't they?
Now,
or I'll write an opinion piece. Well, just give Bob a chance. He was doing some other stuff. He hadn't got round to making the phone call, and then he got round to making the phone call, and it was all fine. So that was all a waste of effort on everyone's part.
Mainly your part.
Except
you
my
write,
part.
Write quite a lot of words about this story.
Yeah, but I think that was worth doing.
Do you? Is that going to be in your beefs of the year? Even though it's a resolved beef. Are we allowed resolved beefs in the beef of the year?
Of course.
Anyway, we're now doing internal administration rather than wrapping up this section of the podcast.
Yeah, speaking of reading things, you can read all of those stories in much more detail on the CMU website. If you go to completemusicupdate.com/podcast, you'll find the show notes for this show, and in there you'll find links to all of those stories. So band reunions are a bad thing, which is an indisputable fact that no one can argue against. And one of the great things about the Smiths is that they've never troubled us with such a thing.
They are one of the very few. We really fought the Stone Roses, didn't we? We really fought the Stone Roses. They're never going to reform. And, you know, band reunions are a bit like Star Wars movies, aren't they? You know, the Star Wars prequels were brilliant until they were made. The potential of the Star Wars prequels was exciting. The actual thing, meh. There were some people very excited about the Stone Roses reunion and the new material, but I sort of felt the same about that. It was sort of the potential of a Stone Roses reunion.
Have you heard their new material? It's fucking awful.
The potential of a Stone Roses reunion that was never going to happen was much more exciting than the actual reunion that did then happen. And we're sort of in a point now in terms of bands who could reform because enough of them are still alive. Well, there's now rumour, isn't there, of an Oasis reunion, even though you hope that...
Yeah, but there's been a rumour of an Oasis reunion since the day they split up.
But I suppose ABBA and the Smiths, really, are the two bands who are, all the members are still alive, they could all get on stage and perform, but it seems almost impossible that either of those things will happen, although I worry that this ABBA VR project that we mentioned last week could result in some horrific onstage thing. But other than us agreeing, possibly, that a Smiths reunion would be a bad thing, and therefore no Smiths reunion would be a good thing, there was no Smiths reunion this week, good thing, but why is that newsworthy? That's my question.
Well, it turns out that despite, I mean, if you go, I did this week. I went back and looked through all the quotes that have been given when Morrissey and Johnny Marr get asked whether the Smiths will ever reunite. And usually the quote is, it's not happening. On one memorable occasion, Morrissey's response was, not everyone's a fat old slag. But it turns out in 2008, they did agree to reunite.
Over a drink. In a pub.
Yes. So in a few years ago, Johnny Marr was remastering the Smiths back catalogue. That required some licensing negotiations with Warner. And so him and Morrissey started communicating about that. And then one day it turned out they were actually quite close to each other in Manchester. So they were like, let's just go and chat about this in the pub.
Bearing in mind that they hadn't met face to face in a long time.
Not since the late 90s and the great Smiths fallout trial.
The acrimonious events.
And so they got together in a pub, had a few drinks, Morrissey knocking back the pints, apparently, and Johnny Marr by that point teetotal, and so drinking, I don't know, orange juice or something. And they talked about things and stuff, and then the kind of ongoing rumours of a Smith reunion came up, and they eventually came to the conclusion that actually they might quite like to do that. And so they left the pub thinking, yeah, let's do this. And they talked about it a bit more afterwards.
Yeah, it wasn't just an over-the-drinks thing. There were then subsequent little conversations. Yeah, this might happen.
Yeah, and then they were going to meet up again to talk about it a bit more. But they said basically that it was when Johnny Marr started working with the Cribs.
Which I'd forgotten until this story we reported this week. I'd completely forgotten he had those couple of years in the Cribs.
And then Morrissey was about to release a solo album, so like, right, well, we'll get those out of the way first. And then Johnny Marr went off on tour with the Cribs and then never heard from Morrissey again.
And still hasn't to this day.
I think there was sort of a very minor, like, one-line email communication very, very occasionally. But, yeah, essentially, they've definitely never spoken about this again. And so that dream has died.
So there was no Smiths reunion, which we actually already knew. But what we didn't know was how close we came to a Smiths reunion. Because I suspect back, was it 2008, you say?
Yeah.
We were probably stomping around back then saying, ah, there'll never be a Smiths reunion. Don't worry, there'll never be one. There very nearly was. But it seems that not only did those conversations come to nothing, it's now unlikely those conversations will happen again, certainly from Johnny Marr's perspective.
Yes. Johnny Marr's been doing lots of interviews this week.
He's got a book.
He's got his autobiography.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, because of this, because he's addressed this in the reunion. This story comes from his book. That's why it's come up. And obviously, like every interview, he's asked about the Smiths reunion, but he's actually, for once, quite happy to talk about it. And he was asked if the fact that Morrissey has said that Brexit is magnificent and said that he greatly admires Nigel Farage would be a problem for any Smiths reunion now. And he basically said, yeah, that would be a little bit of an issue. And so it's Nigel Farage who is now keeping them apart.
It's true. There's a little bit of a political divide. So even if they've overcome their personal differences, which I'm not sure they have, but they clearly did for a little while, there's a fundamental political debate that would mean they couldn't get on stage and perform their songs again together.
Yeah, he said that it would be a slight drawback. Those were Johnny Marr's exact words on that.
Although, it's interesting, because obviously the Nigel Farage comments, I can't say Nigel Farage anymore because I interviewed Mark Thomas during the summer and he insists on calling him Nigel Farage because his argument is that Farage is a French pronunciation of the word and Nigel Farage wouldn't like that. So we must call him Nigel Farage. But Morrissey bigging up Nige, another Nige, Morrissey bigging up Nigel Farage, that was quite some time ago, wasn't it?
And that was 2013.
And yeah. I thought it was quite interesting that Johnny Moore, when he was asked about this, said he sort of forgets that that's something Morrissey has said until it's brought up. And it's like, oh, yeah, I've forgotten that that's something Morrissey said. Yeah, that would probably be an
issue.
Because
I guess the Morrissey in his mind would not have said those. It's interesting, actually. It's like now, actually, the Smiths have been split up now for quite a few years longer than any of the members had been alive at the point that they did split. Because they were like, they were only like 23 when they split up.
Yeah, it's mad they achieved all of that quite so young.
Yeah.
Well done them for doing that.
Well done them. And now, obviously, now Morrissey has grown into the man he has become. And, I guess if you haven't really spoken to someone since their early 20s, in your head, they would still be the same person when, I don't think he is.
So whatever it is you may think or say about Nigel Farage, at least he is helping prevent a Smiths reunion. Although Johnny Moore did then sort of imply that even if Morrissey was to come out tomorrow and say, actually, I was joking, I hate Nigel Farage, there still wouldn't be a reunion.
Yeah, he was like, I'm having a nice time with my solo career. When I'm in New York and playing shows, Andy Rourke from The Smiths comes and plays with me then, and that seems like enough. You know, that's a sort of reunion. There's no need to go any further than that. So let's just stop thinking that Nigel Farage has any redeeming qualities.
And rest assured, sleep peacefully at night, bearing in mind that in the next 7 days we might end up with Donald Trump in charge of the most powerful country in the world. But at least we can sleep at night knowing that there ain't going to be a Smiths reunion.
There is always that.
So there's always an upside to things that are happening in the world. Hey, I've got a meeting to go to, so you better wrap up this podcast.
You're late for it.
Yeah, I've got to go meet Kev from The Great Escape, and I'm already 6 minutes late. So you do the credits extra fast.
Okay, well, we've come to the end of the podcast, as we so often do.
We're going to deliberately make this long drawn out now.
Why not leave us now and listen to some music? You could listen to The Smiths, safe in the knowledge that they're never going to get back together. Or you could listen to some new music. You could search CMU Approved in 2016 on Spotify, and you'd find a playlist of pretty much everything that's featured in the CMU Approved column in 2016, and you could listen to that. New acts on that list in the last week include Frederick Robinson and A.L., whose name I've never had to say out loud properly.
But let's go with that.
Whose name I've never had to say out loud before. So
that's probably about right, but I will check with Mark Thomas this week just in case you didn't get it quite right.
Also, why not go and tell two friends about this podcast?
Well, I'll go and tell Kev at The Great Escape about this podcast.
I mean, don't just tell them. Like, tell them they should listen to it.
If you hurry
up. I mean,
up,
like, the conversation
credits
would probably go something like, hey, listen to any good podcasts lately? And they might say, oh, I don't know. What's good? Or they might say, oh, I'm quite excited about The Bugle coming back.
Yeah.
I've been listening to that. Now we're two episodes into the new series of The Bugle, who have a similar series numbering policy to us.
Do they?
Series 3 of The Bugle had one episode in it. That's back. And then you could go, oh, you like The Bugle. Well, there's this podcast called the CMU podcast.
That's hosted by Chris Cook and Andy Moulton, produced by Matt Peaty.
That's not the order we put our names in, Christopher.
So
I've
done that bit now.
And then
so you
could
just
say,
do the web address and we can finish.
It's a real good podcast. You'd definitely be interested. And I mean, it's about the music industry, but it's like fun and entertaining. And I mean, I know people who listen to it, members of my own family, granted, but they don't work in the music business or really have any knowledge of the music business. So I think you should just check it out. You know, if you like The Bugle, you might like that because it sounds of people talking, and clearly you're into that. So, yeah.
I love how you, despite trying to drag this podcast out even longer, you really ran out of words there.
Well, you're making it longer now by commenting on fact that I'm just dragging it out.
For more on CMU.
No. This podcast was presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook which is the correct order. It was produced by Matt Peaty.
He doesn't need crediting twice.
For more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Goodbye.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an Unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
Right, I'm going.
Managed to make that 3 minutes. That's pretty good.